sweet friend. This is Deeper Life, and I'm your host, Alexis Teichmiller. I'm a writer, content creator, and a woman on a journey to finding more depth in life. If you crave soul-filling conversations and long for a stronger connection to yourself and others, consider this your safe haven. It can be hard to embrace who we are, let alone share that with the rest of the world. The Deeper Life podcast is a safe place to show up and hear conversations about relationships, emotional growth, and explore what it means to be vulnerable. If you're ready to dig deeper, I'm here to help you embrace who you are, reflect on your past, and connect with yourself. Welcome to A Deeper Life. Hello, friends. I am so excited about this episode. And I feel like I bring an equal amount of energy to every single episode because I just love all the different conversations I get to have with such incredible, intelligent, kind, and vulnerable people. And this episode is definitely no exception. I was reached out to by Thomas, his team, and I just knew it was going to be an incredible fit after digging into his podcast. And so today on the show, we have Thomas Westenholz, and he has a podcast and a business called Zen Sensa. And I went deep into his podcast episodes. You know, anytime I'm about to have a conversation with someone on the Deeper Life podcast, I go all in on them. So I want to learn as much as possible about them and their ideologies and what they teach and who they are and what they care about so that we can bring a serious level of depth to the podcast. And so we were really able to achieve that with this episode. We go really, really deep. And I want to give you a little bit of background on Thomas. So Thomas is a relationship expert, author, and podcast host who specializes in helping couples transform their conflicts into lasting love. Thomas has also been trained in the Somatica Method, and the Somatica Method is a holistic, loving, and systematic approach to sex and relationship coaching that invites people to move beyond shame, clarify their needs and boundaries, live emotionally connected, and embody their lives, as well as experience the joy and satisfaction of physical intimacy and authentic relationships. I learned so much. I prepped a lot for this episode, but I learned so much from Thomas in this episode, and I know that you will too. Whether you are single, dating, engaged, in a long-term partnership, married, you know, whatever your romantic relationship status is right now, this podcast is not only going to help you with that partnership with someone else, but it's really going to help you understand yourself in a new way and what you bring into relationships, the triggers, the attachment styles. And so in today's episode, we talk through key attachment moments and attachment styles. Like the emotional attachment styles. We also talk through breaking trust and rebuilding or restoring trust after it's broken. We talk about individualism versus attachment needs. So our individual needs versus the attachment needs we need with someone else. We also talk through triggers in relationships and how those can affect the communication whenever you are feeling triggered or when something comes up. How do you communicate that with your partner? We talk about so many things. This is like such a deep episode, and I'm so excited and really so grateful for Thomas's wisdom and all of the depth and just education that he brought to this episode. So if you are listening and you're really vibing with the show, it would mean a lot to me if you would screenshot your podcast player, jump over to Instagram and tag me. I love to hear what you're learning, especially from this episode, because it's just incredibly deep. And I'd also, if you are really vibing with the show and you haven't left us a review yet, I would love for you to leave a review. It really gives me the energy to keep going and just also helps with the shareability of the show too. So please leave a review. You can leave us some stars or you can actually write a written review, but any of that means the world to me. All right, let's jump in with Thomas Westenholz. Welcome back to another episode of Deeper Life. I am here with my new friend, Thomas Westenholz. And I can already tell y'all that I am like over the moon excited to chat with Tom because I have binged his podcast. And I'm just like, I feel like I'm in the middle of like a starstruck, like vibes because I just resonate so much with the content that you create and the conversations that you're able to just bring so much depth and vulnerability and honesty to. And so I'm just excited to have you on the Deeper Life today, Tom.
Oh, it's my joy. Thank you for having me on. And I look forward to sharing some useful content, hopefully, with your listeners.
Absolutely. I know that you will. So in the middle of my deep dive binging into your podcast, there were a couple of different things I wanted to chat through. And one of them was this idea of key attachment moments. And it's when you're, well, I guess you can explain it better than I could, but it's when you're in these different seasons of life, these big moments, and it's when you're like desiring to attach with your partner and what happens when they show up for you and then when they don't show up for you.
Yeah, absolutely. We can start there. So I think what's really important to understand, first of all, around these key attachment moments or key moments, as I call them, is the fact that very often people will have an overlying pretty good relationship. They get on very well. They share some common interest. Somehow, part of the connection and intimacy is just gone, and they don't really understand why, because they have a good time when they go on dates, etc. So they're not really sure, and they come and they say, we just don't really feel connected anymore. And very often what has happened when we start exploring and digging deeper is that some of these key attachment moments were misattuned and the partner didn't respond. And what a key attachment moment is, well, we can talk more about this later, but the foundation for any relationship is safety. And there are certain times in life where we feel highly vulnerable and we really need that key person, just like when we were a child and suddenly we fell and hurt ourselves and we really needed our parents to be there and comfort us, right? Mm-hmm. If they don't and laugh at us instead, then that creates an attachment wound. And as same, if suddenly we are in danger one day as a child and our parent don't respond, that creates an attachment wound and trust is broken. And even if everything else is fun, we still underlying don't trust them anymore, right? Mm-hmm. And this is the same in adult relationships. So this could be places like, you know, your wife giving birth and for whatever reason you're not there when she really needs you. It could be somebody, one of you being diagnosed with a severe disease, mental health issue, and the other person just is not there for you when you really need them. Anything where you, it could be somebody just losing their job and their partner's not there. So where we feel really vulnerable and really need that support and our partner to be there. And these moments really are black and white. There are no gray area here for our brain and how we perceive these moments of danger. Mm-hmm. So even if we have a completely valid excuse, and it could be very valid, it could be I was stuck at work and I simply couldn't come because my boss would be furious if I didn't. It doesn't matter. In these moments, the brain only perceives either we are there, which creates safety and trust, or we are not there and we will feel abandoned in a key moment, and that will create that lack of trust. However, the good news is that, you know, we all make mistakes. It's part of life and none of us are perfect partners, neither am I. So what we can do when these wounds are created that will create this lack of trust and these underlying attachment wounds is sit down and have what I call a repair conversation. Mm-hmm. And this is how we rebuild trust. And first of all, the first step to this is always do this when you can sit, when first of all, you have time for each other, you turn off all distractions and you can have eye contact. And this is really important. I see a lot of couples trying to sort out, especially deeper issues like this, when they're driving the car or when they're walking somewhere. When you can only see your partner through your peripheral vision, your fear center, amygdala, is more alert. And it's just how we are wired. We are more alert when we can't fully see something, meaning you're more likely to get triggered again and get into conflict. When you can visually see someone fully right in front of you, your brain feels much more calm and safe. So therefore, always make sure you have that time just for you two and that you can have visual eye contact. And then the hurt person, the partner who felt that they were, you know, neglected, they are expressing their pain. And this is a first step. And if they can, then it's optimal if they can do it without blaming, because that will obviously make it harder to hear. So focus on the emotions and sensations that impacted you, how you felt in that moment. So rather than saying, you know, I can't believe you weren't there at my birth. You're such a shitty husband. That's probably going to make him shut down because mm-hmm. he gets triggered. If instead you focus on you, your experience, and say, you know what? I felt so alone and scared. when I was giving birth and you weren't there, and I really needed you so badly to be there and tell me it was going to be okay and hold my hand. That's a vulnerable way because you focus on your experience rather than telling him how bad he is, right? Mm-hmm. And so that's the first space to express. The second is that your partner then must acknowledge what you have experienced. And that could be me saying, I really hear how alone you felt in that moment. And I feel so, so sorry that it had that impact on you, because I never wanted you to feel that pain and feel alone in that moment. So I acknowledged it. And it's important to realize that acknowledgement is different than agreeing, because sometimes partner will say, oh, but I don't agree with her point. I don't agree with what he said. You don't have to agree to acknowledge somebody else's experience. Acknowledgement just means you acknowledge that this is their experience and therefore it's true for them. Right? And that's very different than saying we agree. We have to acknowledge and show them that we can understand their perspective and their pain.
Yeah.
And then we have to then accept.
There's something about acknowledging it too that creates more connection. Because if you're always trying to agree or disagree, that black or white, it's not always resonating with someone's true experience. And so I love that framing. I'm gonna use that reframing of, I don't always have to agree, but I acknowledge your human experience and your feelings, and that's still important to me.
Yeah, and this goes into other things you might talk about later, such as triggers. Is the fact is you don't have to agree with them how they act or how they think, because we never will fully agree. We're different people with different stories, with different backgrounds, right. But we can always acknowledge. We don't have to agree with our partner's boundaries, but we can still acknowledge and respect them. So this is an important concept to understand. And you're right, there's a lot of connection in acknowledging, because that's partly what we want as humans. That's how we connect, by sharing our experience and having that be met and seen by somebody else. So yeah, it's a really important point. And I think the next step here would then be in this repair process, that the person who hurt their partner, they accept responsibility. And again, you don't have to agree, but you can accept responsibility for the pain that you hear it caused your partner, even if you don't think you did anything wrong. Mm-hmm. You can still, like I just said in my example, say, I'm truly sorry for the impact this had on you, and that you felt alone and that you felt abandoned, because I never wanted that. And then the last step is to state how you will act different in the future, because if nothing will be different, then how are they supposed to trust you next time, right? Mm-hmm. And it's absolutely critical that we then follow through on that. And that could then be me saying, you know what, I acknowledge that I made a misjudgment. I was so worried about our finances and paying the mortgage that I made the wrong choice to stay at work. And I see that now. And I want you to trust me again. And I promise you, next time you need me, just say it's critical and I will always be there. That's an example of how this could go down, right? Mm. So yeah, that's the last piece. And as you start having these repair conversations, and they might have to happen multiple, many times, then slowly, if you follow it up with action, trust will be rebuilt.
Mm-hmm. I love that. I am having almost like a body reaction to you chatting through this, because I'm thinking of a very specific memory with my partner, who is now my husband, where I was in a very key attachment moment where I had just lost someone, and we were in a long distance relationship at the time. And so there's also an element of vulnerability in saying, this is a big moment for me. I need you here. And in that moment, I wasn't vulnerable and said, it's okay. You don't need to fly home for the funeral. I can figure this out on my own, and put up a very tough exterior. And then going through that actual mourning process and not having my partner there, I regretted the decision that I had made. And then I also resented him for not coming anyways. And so then there was almost like this, I let you know that it was okay that you weren't there for me, and kind of took the choice away from you in a way. And then now I'm coming back and regretting the choice. And then now I'm mad about it. Does that make sense?
It absolutely makes sense. And I think it is very vulnerable. And I think we have to look at all these things in a cultural perspective, because we're obviously highly impacted by the culture that we live in. And we live in a culture that glorifies individualism as strong, being able to be on our own. And I'm not saying it's not an important, but we need a balanced approach. And we're not balanced anymore, because there's a spectrum of codependence where we can't be on our own and we, you know, have to constantly be there for somebody else to regulate us. And that's not a very healthy dynamic, but neither is it to be too independent. And we live in a culture that glorify this independence so much and see it as strong. And actually it's not, because mm-hmm. we are neurologically wired and a social creature. So we do need each other. And there's an enormous freedom in acknowledge and accepting that. I struggled for 30 plus years to be vulnerable in any relationships, because I always wanted people to think I could deal with everything myself. You know, whether mm-hmm. it was being told my son was dying in hospital, I would just pretend I was good on my own. I wouldn't ask for help. I was just, I can deal with this, you know, and I would just go on with that facade, even though I was crumbling inside.
Yeah.
And this is, again, a learned behavior, right? But by acknowledging that it's okay to need others mm-hmm. and our needs are valid and they're okay, and when we take away all this shame that has been put on us, you know, even we say, and we can talk more about this maybe later in attachment styles, when we categorize some people as needy, we put this negative label on people so they become afraid of expressing what their actual need are, and therefore they can't get that need met that totally. Would then create safety. So I think we have to look at this in that context of our culture and the society that we live in.
Mm-hmm. Was there a moment you mentioned, like, your own struggle with vulnerability and being open and asking for help? Was there a specific moment maybe in your childhood where you experienced that, like, prominently for the first time, where you were open and you were vulnerable and you asked for help, and then something happened to make you, like, I guess, tap into that learned behavior of, oh no, we keep to ourselves, we're strong, we can figure it out alone?
I think, yeah, there are so many moments. So, you know, I remember being beaten up by these three guys in school. And I remember how, again, it wasn't just one incident. And I learned that, again, by not showing emotions or that it was hurting me, then I was more safe. Then it would be less likely that they would keep hurting me. If I showed that it was causing me pain, then they would hurt me more. So I quickly learned to shut down. You know, when I reached out to adults to try and get help, they just said, oh, you know, don't cry about it. You just find a way to deal with it. And I learned I had to depend on myself, right? And that I could only count on myself. So it doesn't make sense then to reach out. And also, this is part of vulnerability, is the fact that there is a risk of rejection, which is why we fear being vulnerable, right? Mm-hmm. And reaching out and asking your partner to be there for you in that moment put up the possibility that he wouldn't be, and then that disappointment we would feel. So it's both the cultural shame that has been put on us, but it also that fear of then feeling rejected that makes it very, very difficult for us to step into that space. But in not doing so, we inhibit connection and we inhibit getting the support and needs that we actually, you know, need, and therefore instead often build up resentment instead, because we're so afraid. And we all grow up, you know, getting judged and learning very subtly, even without judgment, that to be accepted, which all children have the need for, and even adults, we have to act in certain ways. We learn that our parents only find us acceptable and praise us when we behave in a certain way, right? And certain things are not acceptable. So we hide those parts of ourselves away. Same with our friends, at work, everywhere. But also in exploring and expressing these parts that we've hidden away mm-hmm. is where the real intimacy of a relationship can be, when we're able to express that to our partner and be heard and be seen and be accepted. Again, they don't have to give it to us. And that's what people, again, often get triggered. You know, if somebody shares something with them and they suddenly feel, oh, but I can't give them that, then they feel a fear that they'll be abandoned and the partner might get defensive and judgmental. Mm-hmm. But if we realize we don't have to give everything to our partner, and that's very different, acceptance and having to give it are two very different things again. Mm-hmm. So acceptance is just acknowledging that it's part of them and appreciating that part in them. That's all it really means, you know. And I often give the example when my partner shared a sexual fantasy that I couldn't give her because I wasn't comfortable with that fantasy. Then, you know, I could still accept it and I would never judge her. Instead, I said, it's so beautiful that you shared this with me. What a wonderful. And I totally understand that this is a turn on for you.
Right.
I can't give this to you, but I can tell you this as a story sometimes if that turns you on. And in that way, I both expressed my boundary, but I also accepted and did not shame her around having that, you know, beautiful fantasy that she had. And in that place is a lot of intimacy, because suddenly she feels free to open up and that she doesn't have to hide these parts of herself anymore.
Right. Free and safe. You know, there's a piece of safety there too, where you met her in that moment without judgment or shame, and you were able to listen and acknowledge. And even though, again, you said you set a boundary that you weren't comfortable, you still made her feel safe to come to you instead of go to someone else or keep it in the whole time.
That's right. And this is why when we started, I said safety is the foundation. And that's exactly like you're highlighting now, because without safety, we can't open up to the next step, which is vulnerability. Mm-hmm. And therefore, we cannot progress and we cannot get to a place where we ever create intimacy if there is no safety. And I think often the question people then ask me, how do I know if it's safe to be vulnerable? Well, I say there's a very good way to start. And it makes sense that, you know, not everybody is safe to be vulnerable. Well, some people are judgmental. Some people will not be able to meet us. So what I do mm-hmm. or what I would do if I were out meeting a partner, even if I share with friends, is I categorized my vulnerabilities. I literally looked at some of my vulnerabilities and said, you know, this is a level one, meaning, you know, if somebody says, oh, that's a bit weird, then it might be a bit uncomfortable, but it's not a big deal. Level 10 is if somebody said, oh, that's really weird, then it would really devastate me and impact me really badly. And I will start just sharing a level one vulnerability, right? That's not such a big risk. It's a small risk. Mm-hmm. And then I'll see, how do they respond? Do they respond with acceptance and encouragement? Or are they judgmental? Again, if they're judgmental, maybe don't share level two vulnerability with that person. Maybe share another level one and see, is that a pattern? Or are they able to actually meet you? Also, how do they talk about others? If they're a person that when you're out, they're really judgmental and mm-hmm. they say, oh, look at her in that dress. She shouldn't be wearing that. Then again, maybe be careful sharing vulnerability with that person if you notice that. If they, on the other hand, are very accepting towards others and stand up for people that are being put down, and hey, that's a good sign that they might be more safe. So there will be lots of small indicators where you can start picking up in their behavior whether they're a person that's safe to share with. People often are very comfortable. Like, I just met a woman recently who basically shared with me some really traumatizing experience with me, literally the first time I spoke to her. And she said, I've never shared this with anybody. You know, even some of my partners don't even know this. And she said, but somehow I feel safe with you. And it's because that, one, I share vulnerability myself, but also in the way she has seen me act. So her system recognized that it was safe to share because there would be no judgment. She could see that in the way I spoke about other people to other people, et cetera, et cetera.
And that's really special too. I mean, that's something that, one, you can be a safe place for other people, and then you can exemplify and be aware of, almost like, you know, you've got your radar out of like, okay, you know, and taking inventory and collecting this like emotional data of hearing how people are speaking about people, how are they making you feel when you're with them? And this is actually a question I get a lot too of, Alexis, I want to go deeper in my existing relationships, or I want to open myself up to new friendships, and I want those friendships to be rooted in depth and vulnerability. How do I do that? And I feel like your scale of 1 to 10, and then just kind of testing it out and seeing how they respond, is such a good way to start. And it doesn't feel like there's too many rules, you know? It's like you're just kind of testing it. You're keeping it light without putting too much pressure on the friendship.
That's right. Exactly. And it also brings us an awareness about our own vulnerabilities anyway to do that exercise, you know? So I might start by sharing somebody I met about how once I did a podcast and it went really bad. And that's the first little vulnerability I share, because if they say, oh, that's really bad, you didn't prepare properly, why did you not do that? If they're judgmental, then it's not really that devastating for me, right? Because it's not that vulnerable, right, that I messed up a podcast, but I probably wouldn't share a childhood trauma with them straight away, because that would be way too big a risk to take. And also, trust has to be earned. So it makes sense to build it up slowly in this way. It's how organically we would do that, and normally if we are emotionally attuned, we would tune in and see whether that person is safe. But again, it's good to have a framework as well to work with.
Absolutely. I want to jump back to the you said attachment styles earlier, of, you know, someone that could be labeled as needy. Like, I'd love to talk through all the different attachment styles, because I think that a lot of my community members, whether they're in a relationship or even in a friendship, because I think that a lot of that's transferable. Your attachment style to a friend is probably similar to your attachment style to a romantic partner. And so I'd love to talk through those different layers.
Absolutely. And you're right, they are the same. It's the only difference is, the closer we are to someone, the more prominent these patterns become. So essentially, attachment styles, is how we learn to feel safe as children. It's a dynamic that we have with our main caregivers, whether that's our parent or whoever might have been closest to us. And they're also impacted by close people in our childhood, like close friends, close family members, etc. And essentially what happens, so we can go over, there's four main attachment styles. And the reason it's important to understand your own and your partner's is that they play out in different dynamics and they have different needs to feel safe. And if we don't understand those, then we are likely to get caught in a cycle of conflict again and again and again and be completely unaware that it's simply these toxic cycles of our attachment styles we get stuck in, of how we learn to feel safe. So if we start with the first one, it's called anxious attachment. And anxious attachment very much come from people who had inconsistent caregivers. So it could be your mom or your dad was an alcoholic, and one moment they were really affectionate and paid attention to your needs. The other moment they were not there at all and they were drunk and just switched off, right? Mm-hmm. It could be that one of your parents suddenly left you. Dad suddenly went away and never came back. And again, this has created a wound that means that this anxious attached people often worry about whether their partner will be responsive to them or whether you will leave them. And again, understanding their history, it makes complete sense. It's a completely natural way that the brain learned that, okay, this is not fully safe and there's a likelihood that I will be left, so I have to protect myself from that pain. And therefore, the sad part is that very often in our society, again, we label these people and shame them by calling them needy. And because we do that, they don't feel they can express their need openly or vulnerable. If they could that, they could simply say what their need are. We could give it to them and they would feel safe. So what very often happens is that the anxious attached people will, you know, try and control. They will try and lash out because they worry about you not being responsive to them or that you might leave. And like I said, just being aware, if we knew this, if they could say, listen, I have slightly anxious attached, you know, when you go out with your friends, then I really have a need for you to just send me a text or give me a quick call so I know everything is all right and you're just out with your friends. And I can say, yeah, sure, that's no problem. There we go, problem solved. And that will start calming down, you know, her nervous system that I'm able to do that. But she can only express that again if there's not this judgment. Mm-hmm. If somebody starts saying, oh, you're being so needy, then of course they will shut down and you will never understand that underlying need that they need, which by the way is not needy. It's a totally logical need to have for someone who had that experience. Right. So to jump to the next attachment style, which is avoidant. And this is essentially children that learned that, you could say a bit like what I described to you earlier of my experience, they learned that they had to take care of themselves, that if they needed help, they were on their own. And what very often happens is they simply don't trust other people for good reason, because they had experience as a child that nobody would meet them when they needed them. And maybe it's a child that had to grow up really fast and act like an adult. And very often what happened is that when they're stressed, they will back down. And again, their behavior is avoidant, meaning they often struggle with intimacy. They fear getting too close to people, which makes sense if you don't trust others, right?
Right.
And often these people are, again, in our society, looked at as being very confident, because often they seem like they don't care and they're willing to walk away. But this is not confident. And actually, when we measure their nervous system, they often have higher stress levels than the anxious attached one, meaning they're actually more anxious. They just don't show it because they have a different coping strategy. But it's important to understand that this is not what confidence is. And I think that's a big misunderstanding in our society. And often the dynamic that happens is that anxious and avoidant very often get attracted to each other. And the anxious will try and reach out to get reassurance. The avoidant will obviously pull back more. And pulling back more will make the anxious even more anxious. And right. Then the avoidant feel more controlled. And then they spin into this vicious cycle until they break up or it becomes really toxic. Wow. If they just knew each other's attachment styles, the avoidant could just say, oh, I get it. So what is it actually you need right now? Okay, so you need reassurance. Oh, that's great. I'm here with you and I love you and I don't want to be with anybody else. And then you sit down, you hold their hand and you say, I'm here, we're together and you're the one I want to be with. Boom, the anxious will start calming down. Guess what? Their controlling behavior will become less. Same, if they're avoidant, if you know your partner's avoidant and he comes home stressed and he needs time to himself, then if you're anxious, you can just also remind yourself and say, oh, you know, he's avoidant, so therefore he deals with stress by going off on his own. It doesn't mean he's leaving me. And it means, again, you can calm yourself down and give him that space he needs before he comes back again and try and reconnect, right?
Yeah.
So in this way, when we can understand these dynamics, we don't have to get caught in a toxic cycle. And the last, or there's two more. One of them is secure attachment, which is very lucky people who basically had very responsive parents. So they're both very comfortable being on their own, but also very comfortable with intimacy. They're quite easy to be in relationship with most of the time. And the last one is ambivalent attachment style, where you have a mixture between anxious and avoidant. And this is very often associated with traumatic experiences. So it will often be somebody who actually want you close, like the anxious one, try to get you close. But then when you get close, like the avoidant, they will push you away because they get uncomfortable being too close. So they will constantly go this push-pull, which is very, very draining. And again, it can be healed. I think it's important to say that when I talk about these attachment styles, it's not for people to go home and say, oh, I heard this podcast and you're X, Y, and Z. No, we are not. Attachment styles are not fixed. They can change over time. If you create a secure dynamic, like I described above, then slowly you can both become more securely attached. And over time, I think it's on average 2 years it takes to rewire, you can start actually changing your attachment style. So we can actually heal each other and the attachment wound that we had, which is a beautiful part of relationships.
That is beautiful. Which one of those attachment styles would you say you resonate the most with?
So I think now I resonate with secure attachment. I think I definitely had, again, you have to look at this as a spectrum. So it's not that we are, you are anxious, you are avoidant. Like you can be highly, highly avoidant.
Right.
You can be middle, you can be a tiny bit avoidant, right? Mm-hmm. There's a spectrum, same with anxious. And again, you also have to realize that these dynamics impact each other. Like the example I gave earlier, if someone anxious is with someone highly avoidant and they're unaware, they will probably become more anxious, right, than their normal default place. And the avoidant might be a little avoidant, but become highly avoidant. So we can move each other on this scale. It's dynamic. And I think for myself, in my natural state now is that I'm securely attached, but I have certainly lived a lot of my life with patterns of avoidant attachment style as well, which is more typical for men anyway. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I think that's where I feel I am currently at that spectrum. But again, it can move, you know.
Right.
If I'm with somebody highly anxious, that could start impacting me too. And also two anxious people or an avoidant anxious, etc., could create a secure dynamic. This is the interesting thing. If they have this knowledge, you can still create a secure dynamic, even though none of you have a secure attachment style.
Interesting. Is that just because you are aware you're communicating about it?
Yeah, it's if you have the skill and awareness, like I said before, if let's say my partner's slightly anxious and I recognize that and I'm able to get her to express vulnerably what her needs actually are, then I can start trying to accommodate those needs. And in doing so, she will obviously start feeling more safe. And over time, as she sees consistency, that she will feel more and more safe, meaning we're creating a secure relationship dynamic, even though we maybe are individually one secure and one anxious attached, right? Mm-hmm. But because we understand those underlying safety needs, we can create a secure attachment together.
Right. I would say in my life, I actually feel just hearing you talk about this, and this is my first time ever hearing it with this language. And that's why I think language is so beautiful, because once you have language to something, you can really find a lot of clarity and awareness. Because I've heard the, like, you know, are you the runner? Are you the one that digs in? Like, I've heard that kind of language. But I would say I'm probably bored, like, in the ambivalent attachment. And then on my way to secure attachment. But that's something I can definitely resonate with, the feeling needy. And then what I wrote down after avoidant attachment was self-preservation. And that's something in my childhood and in my teenage years, self-preservation was a very big coping mechanism, like an emotional survival mechanism of like, I can figure this out on my own. I don't need anyone. But then there's that needy element too, where it's like, I just want someone to see me. I just want someone to, you know, make me feel like I'm important. And so I never thought that those two things together would make this ambivalent attachment. And this makes so much sense.
Yeah. And I think what's important that I just want to mention too, and thank you for sharing that, is the fact that attachment styles very much describe our behavior, meaning the way that we choose to behave to feel safe, not necessarily how we feel. And again, like I said, with the avoidant, somebody who might act avoidant actually feel highly anxious inside at the same time,
right,
and can feel highly stressed. And it doesn't mean that the avoidant doesn't mean doesn't want intimacy. They have a need too to be seen. They just don't have a fundamental trust that anyone will actually give them that, and therefore it's more safe to act avoidant. So a lot of these core needs we have are all the same for all of us and for all these attachment styles. We all have the need to feel secure and safe. We all have the need to feel seen and valued and feel we are part of something. That is a human universal need, independent on attachment styles.
Absolutely. Earlier you mentioned the triggers and being triggered inside of a relationship. And I think, I mean, we're just talking about the attachment styles, and then we talked about, you know, restoring trust after key attachment moments. I definitely think like the natural next thing to chat through is triggers and how those are brought up and how that might amplify that spectrum of your attachment, as well as, you know, how are you helping your partner or friend through, you know, a trigger that happened within the relationship?
That's a great question. Thank you for bringing that up. And I really think that I normally use the analogy that when we're in a relationship, we often have this idea, oh, we love each other, so we should know, they should know what I need or how I think or why I'm upset, right? This idea that we should have telepathy and we'd be able to read each other's minds. The fact is, we can't. I know it's a beautiful, beautiful romantic idea, but right, we can't. And just like, you know, if I travel to America and have to find a new place, I don't know how to get there. And, you know, the best way for me to get there is by having a map. You know, I put on Google Maps, and the great thing is, even if I take a wrong turn, then Google Maps will reroute me and I find my way there to my destination eventually. Mm. Being a couple is the same. We need to give each other a map, because otherwise, of course, we're going to keep stepping on each other's old wounds and triggers again and again and again, being unaware that we're doing it. So we need to get that self-awareness of ourselves. And that means looking back in our history and try and look at things in our relationships or in the current moment where we have a highly emotional response. If we have a very high emotional response, it's very likely a trigger in the past is associated with this, something that happened that made you feel much more intense about what's happening in the current moment. And this is really important to communicate to our partner, because if you just start lashing out at them, they will obviously be triggered too. And their adrenaline response will kick in, fight or flight, and you will end up just having a fight and go at each other. If instead we can explain to our partner why we have these triggers, why, the why is what creates empathy in our brain. And this is what Hollywood has got very right. Their idea about what romance is not very precise, but their understanding of when we know the why behind a character, we feel empathy for that character, even if he does something we don't like in a movie, right? Mm-hmm. Once we understand what happened to him to become that person, we feel empathy. Guess what? It's the same with our partner. So, you know, if your partner suddenly, you, let's say, and use this example sometimes, but let's say the husband leaves the house, he slams the door, and the wife gets up, she runs after him and scream, how dare you do that, you inconsiderate X, Y, and Z, swear word. And he turns around and he said, don't talk to me like that, you are so aggressive, blah, blah, blah. And then they have an argument, and none of them are actually hearing each other, what's going on. And none of it has to do with what just happened. If instead she had the self-awareness to reflect, she might be able to communicate and say, listen, when I was a child, my dad was an alcoholic. When he would get drunk, he would scream at me and he would always leave the house and slam the door. So when I hear that sound, it really triggers me. Great. Now you have given me a point on your map. That means that I can avoid going down that road that's blocked and I can take a way around instead. So I can avoid triggering you. And if I do by mistake trigger you, because it could happen, I forget once in a while and still slam the door. Then when you come out and say, how dare you do that? I know it's not an attack on me anymore, so my adrenaline gland doesn't have to kick in. I can see, oh, she remember me and see me as what her dad did right now. And I can go up and say, listen, honey, I'm really sorry about that. I can put my hand on her hand and say, you're safe. Everything is fine. I'm sorry. And that will calm her down, right? Mm-hmm. And that's because I know the why. I won't take it as a personal attack. So this is giving each other that map of who we are, of where the minds are, so we can avoid stepping on them and losing our legs, but instead just walk around them, right? And if we step on them, we can come and disarm the mind before it blows up. And I think part of this is also learning how can we calm ourselves down and calm our partner down, which is what's called regulation. And there's self-regulation. And often I say, if your partner is the one who triggered you, then I recommend doing self-regulation first, because your partner can't normally regulate you. And the best way to do this, if you think about our adrenaline and fight and flight, it's a response that was made to either make you fight a threat or run away. It's very primitive. And once that hijacked your brain, you're outside what's called your window of tolerance. Logic is out the window. So forget trying to talk logic and solve anything logically. It will not work. Even your memory is highly defect when you're in fight or flight. So what you need to do is move your body. That could be, you know, if you feel the urge to fight, go upstairs and punch a pillow. If you can do a dance in a living room, which I do sometimes, you could squeeze a pillow. You could go for a run. Whatever you need to do, move your body, because that's how we restore calm when adrenaline is released in the body. And it's the most effective way, without a doubt, because it's how biologically we were wired to release that response. So move, and it's a constructive way to use it. That will help you calm down. And then at the same time, use slow, mindful breathing that will activate something called your parasympathetic nervous system and what's called your smart vagus nerve that will basically calm down your body too and tell your body to go into a restful, calm state. So these two together will allow you to calm down. And only when you feel in that place again, within your window of tolerance, should you go and engage with your partner again, because anything before that point will be, well, pointless. And and what you can do for co-regulation, meaning regulate each other, if let's say, you know, the trigger is an external threat, maybe somebody, your partner come home and they're really angry over something at work, then you can help co-regulate each other. You can do this through eye contact, through touch, through attachment reassurance, and say, I'm here for you, baby, we're in this together, so we'll figure this out together, you're not alone. And that will help regulate their nervous system down as well. Mm-hmm. And having the ability to know how to regulate each other is an absolutely critical skill in any relationship.
I completely agree. It's so just going off of that, and as you're talking, I'm thinking so much about my own relationship, which is what, you know, the whole point of this conversation, and I hope is what the community gets from it as well, is, you know, where are you finding yourself in this narrative? And this co-regulation strategy and tactic is so helpful, because I realize that when I'm upset, my partner's reaction is to come hug me and want to be like physical touch. You know, it's part of his love language is I want physical touch because you're upset. And when I'm upset, I don't want anyone to touch me at all. And like, that's a part of that co-regulation, is he's recognizing, I want to go to you. I want to hug you. I want to hold your hand. But I also know that where you are right now emotionally, you do not want to be touched. And so we had to learn that over time with each other. And sometimes he'll like almost stop himself. Like he'll like be going in for a hug and I'm like, no, 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 remember? And then we're able to just work through that together without it causing additional emotional stress. And it's just, I know you very well and I know that you don't want to be touched right now. And that's been really helpful for us in those moments where we are, you know, the heart rates are elevated. We're like borderline outside of that window, you know, the window of tolerance.
And that's beautiful. That's essentially what you're describing now, is giving each other a map. Start teaching each other about yourself and what mm-hmm. you need and what triggers you, etc. And that way you can navigate each other much more successfully, which is so important. And also part of this is learning, you know, this was part of my somatic training I did in San Francisco, is to learn to, because we grow up in a culture, again, that values our logical, cognitive, higher thinking so much, and not very much the emotional brain. And below that, we have the sensation brain that basically is able to sense our body. And we never get any training in this, even though this is the most accurate system at telling us what's going on. And it works much faster than our cognitive thought. It's the instant response system. So being able to tune in to what we're feeling makes us also be able to know, for example, am I getting close now to being outside my window of tolerance? Logically, you won't know that until it's too late, trust me. But I know, for example, by having learned in to sense my own body very quickly and the nuances, I can know when I'm getting close, because first of all, I know my stomach start to tense up. So as soon as my stomach start tensing, I realize, okay, adrenaline has been released in my body. Then I notice my jawline. When my jawline is getting tight, again, that's my fight or flight response. And I just know that it might be different for you. Mm-hmm. But I know that. And that means as soon as I sense that, I realize fight or flight has kicked in. And then I recognize what I need to do. And I might even, you know, could say to my partner and say, listen, I can feel I'm really triggered right now. I do want to hear you. but I'm unable to do that right in this moment. I need to regulate myself. And then I can just do that. I give them the reassurance, because if you just leave, they will often feel abandoned, right? And that might trigger them more. So I will say to them what's happening, what I need, and also reassure them that I'll come back. And then I will remove myself and regulate myself, because before I do that, I know nothing constructive can come. And it's better I can pick it up early, because once we're outside our window of tolerance, none of these skills work anymore, because right. then we lost control and our animalistic fight or flight has taken over and is just wanting to survive. And right now it's seeing your partner as a threat. So you can be sure you'll be attacking that poor person in front of you and probably saying nasty things. So it's important to learn to sense when we are going into that response so we can disengage before we go over that window of tolerance.
I'm such a fighter, Tom. Like, I'm coming for you, you know? And so when you're talking through the sensation of recognizing like what's happening in your body when you're triggered or when you're getting that extreme heightened emotional experience, I didn't realize it, but I cock my jaw to one side and I kind of start to grit my teeth. Like, as you were talking through that, I was like, what's like my pattern? And that's it. And I'm like, ooh, when I do that, we've got to, you know, communicate what's happening and take a moment to self-regulate instead of just jumping right in. So
perfect.
Thank
Beautiful.
You so
yeah.
much for that.
And I'm the same as you. Like, I have that natural instinct to fight. So, which is great. I have a boxing pillow in my art house and, you know, that doesn't get hurt by me going out and punching it. And
right.
neither does my bedroom pillow. And again, if your partner knows and you communicated this, they don't get scared. They know you're literally just regulating, right? I can just say, I need 10 minutes on the boxing pad and great, right? Then I go out there and they know I'm a totally safe person who would never mm-hmm. touch them. So it's fine. It's just a natural, healthy way for me to release that response. So it's so good. And for people who are not aware, because there might be people sitting out and thinking, great, that they know their stuff, but I have no idea how to sense this. A great way to do this is to sit with somebody that you trust. It can be a partner. It can also be a friend if you don't have a partner. And then where you can sit next to each other and you can talk about things that might trigger you. It could be being touched in a certain way. It could be certain words that trigger you. And now with this trusted partner, try and sit and slowly let them build up to doing this place where it violates you a little bit, your boundaries, and start mm-hmm. triggering you. And just pay attention to how it feels in your body. And don't caretake the partner who does it. Don't worry about hurting their feelings. That's not your job. Your job is just to feel, how does it feel when I start feeling violated? And then say stop. So it's both a good practice in asserting your boundaries, but it's also great practice in somatically start sensing when you're in a safe place, because once you're unsafe, you normally cannot sit and practice and learn to tune in. So this is a place to do with a safe person when you're feeling calm of starting to slowly build up that skill set.
Mm-hmm. And two, when you're in a moment or in a conversation with a partner or a trusted friend, or even sometimes acquaintances, I've been in some interesting, triggering conversations with people I don't know very well. And it's like, how do you confidently and firmly set a boundary where I'm not comfortable talking about that? I am feeling really triggered right now. I would prefer to change the topic. And I think for my experiences as a woman, I have felt that I have been in conversations with men who are not, you know, close friends, and that I'm starting to feel very triggered by their language, their tone, their topic. And I have a hard time using my voice in those moments. And this really happened to me when I was younger, in my early 20s, when I was just trying to navigate like the social career spectrum. And it's really interesting just seeing that dynamic too of when do we feel comfortable using our voice and using and actually practicing boundaries. And like, I don't have any issue doing that with my partner. I don't have any issue doing that with my parents, but sometimes it can feel harder when it's someone you don't know very well. Does that make sense?
Absolutely. And you know what? I think it goes back to what we just talked about before. The fact is, again, it's a learned behavioral pattern, right? And there's an emotional response associated with that that makes you more uncomfortable. And the way to practice is to slowly start upping the scale of finding someone where it's not really uncomfortable, maybe just a little bit, someone you normally wouldn't do it with, and start practicing doing it with them. And then slowly do it in a place where it's a bit harder and slowly build it up. Like with everything else, it's a skill. Mm-hmm. And skills, when we build skills, any skill, by the way, any skill you want to learn in life, it's part of psychology, and the theory is called flow. And it's basically about finding the right place where there's enough of a challenge for you to learn and grow, but the challenge is not so big that it feels overwhelming. If it feels overwhelming, you don't learn. If it's understimulating, there's no growth, right? Mm-hmm. So you need to sense where the place where this feels a bit challenging, and then you can say, oh, let me play here, but it doesn't feel overwhelming. And right. This is how we learn all skills. So apply the flow theory to find people that are safe, but maybe it would be a bit difficult practice, and then up the practice as you get better. Mm-hmm. And again, go back to vulnerability, because we can be firm and vulnerable. You know, I can express my boundary and be very vulnerable about it. So it doesn't have to be, I used to think back in the day, because that's what I learned as a child, that boundaries required me to get angry. I had to mobilize anger. Mm-hmm. And that became very draining for me, because, and also it would obviously often cause conflict. So it wouldn't get a good response, and it would really drain my system, because it means every time I felt uncomfortable, I had to mobilize anger, right? Which became really stressful, and my body got really tired. And then I learned I don't have to, because once, the only reason I needed anger is because I didn't trust myself. Once I learned to trust myself, to assert my boundaries, I no longer needed anger, because I realized at any point that somebody did not respect my boundary, I could just walk away. And I have done that many, many times, you know. Even recently, my beautiful, wonderful ex-wife, and she's a wonderful woman and a wonderful mother. And sometimes, you know, most of the time we get on really, really well. And sometimes she will call me up and she will be triggered. She will have a stressful day and she'll suddenly go off about some things that hurt her that happened 5-6 years ago. And I will often say to her really calmly, because I trust myself to enforce my boundary, I said to her, listen, I really want to hear what it is that you need, but I don't want to get your anger. That you need to process with a therapist or with friends, not with me. And if she then stops and comes down, then I will listen to her need. If she can't, I will just say to her, I'll hang up now and you can contact me when you calmed, regulated yourself. And then I'll happily listen to you. And then I will hang up. And, you know, I've done that over the last couple of years, a couple of times, and it works great. Then she regulate herself down and then she will say, oh yeah, I think I was triggered, but actually this is what I need. I need your help with X, Y, and Z. And I said, thank you for expressing that. Now I can hear you. So again, it's also trusting that we can just walk away if people actually don't respect our boundary, because we value the way we want to be treated more than we value that connection with that person. And to be honest, that is a wonderful place to get to. And it's also how we can relate more healthy to other people when we realize that we need to value our own boundaries higher than, well, I would say any connection really, if there are critical boundaries for our well-being.
Yeah, and that also builds that trust and confidence and connection with self. Like I trust right. and believe in myself so much. I know my values. I know how I want people to treat me. I know how I want to treat other people. And when I feel like my boundaries are being infringed upon or not being respected after being communicated, then I want to continue that connection with self. And so I must disconnect from this person that is infringing upon, you know, my connection. And I recently, I have a resident therapist on the Deeper Life podcast, and her name is Marlene. And she was talking about how a lot of times boundaries, people think that you have to, again, like you said, activating that anger. And a lot of it is, how can I love me well and you well at the same time? And a lot of that is, I want to respect me and respect the relationship. And so I need to set a boundary. And if that's not being, if that's not being respected, then you have to resort back to loving yourself well. And that sometimes means, you know, like you said, hanging up, communicating why you're hanging up, and then hanging up and letting that person sit and regulate themselves before engaging again. I think that's really powerful. And if we can get in the practice of giving ourselves permission to do that, because I think a lot of times it's like, well, I don't want to be mean, or I don't want to hurt their feelings, or I don't want to seem like I don't care, or I don't want to be cold. And so sometimes I think when you're doing this emotional work, you know, you're feeling connected. There's this warmth, there's this energy. And sometimes when you do have to put a boundary in place, sometimes my narrative, I'm not projecting this, but sometimes my narrative is, well, I'm doing all this like empathetic, emotion-driven work, and, you know, to be super connected with myself and other people. And I don't want to like be mean, you know, and I don't want to be too firm to where someone feels like they can't come to me. And so it's, again, it's that skill, that practice that you're building up over time, where it's not mean to set a boundary. It's really rooted in connection, because it's like, I want you to treat me well. I want to treat you well. Here are the confines in which we do that.
That's right. And even, you know, I think that's beautifully said. And what I often say, because again, because of our culture, you're right. Very often there is this perception that you said, oh, we have to caretake the other people's emotions. And I would even say that it's one of the biggest gifts that we can give to any relationship. Because first of all, resentment is one of the biggest killers of relationships long term. And if we let people continuously violate our boundaries, we will eventually build up resentment, which will cause the relationship to deteriorate. And like you said, connection will be broken anyway. So by enforcing our boundaries, we maintain that connection is possible and that we avoid resentment. That's number one. Number two, if you have people that care about you in your life, friends, family, they obviously want you well. And they don't want to violate you. And the fact that they can trust that you can take care of their own boundaries actually gives them more freedom. People often think freedom is having no boundaries. Freedom only exists within boundaries. Because if I can trust you, if you were my partner and I can trust you to assert your boundaries, I don't have to constantly caretake you and worry, if I do this, will that upset her? Will that overstep? Because I know you will just tell me. Mm-hmm. And that gives me much more freedom to be free. You know, women I work with who learn to assert their boundaries suddenly say, you know what? I feel so free to go flirt with men. Because before I was scared that if I flirted, suddenly that meant that I had to go along and then have sex. It suddenly, you know, it kept escalating. Mm-hmm. And I don't always want that. Sometimes I just want to flirt. And once they learn to trust their own boundaries, they can go flirt and realize it's fine. At any point when it goes too far for them, they just assert their boundary in a loving way and say, actually, this is as far as I want to go. And of course, if that's not respected, they disengage. And if people won't respect your boundaries and don't care about violating you, then it's great that you don't have them in your life. So this will naturally filter out people that are not meant for connection with you.
Mm-hmm. And I think there's also this this cultural thing of this obligation of friendships, even if, like, let's say you've had friends for a long time, or they're friends out of tradition or out of, you know, geographical location. And so the longer you're in the friendship, the harder it is to leave. And the longer you're in a relationship, the harder it is to leave. And so this idea of resentment can really come into those long-term friendships and long-term relationships where maybe you're growing, you're feeling more enlightened about yourself, you're connected to self, you are starting to understand your boundaries, your communication and attachment style. And then when you try to practice that with people who maybe are not on that same journey, and you continue to try and exert effort, but if it's still not, you know, it's not reciprocated or there's not that mutual respect, it's harder to, I've found that it's hard to let friendships that you've had for a long time go, even if there isn't that mutual respect of, I'm putting a boundary in place. I don't want to talk about someone that's not in the room. And that it makes them feel uncomfortable, and then they feel like they're judged. And so it's this interesting dance when it's like, at what point and how do you let a relationship or friendship go after you have tried to set these boundaries and you've tried to be communicative and it's still not landing?
So I think there's two things to say to this. So first of all, as we grow, some people will always fall apart and new people will come in. That's just how it naturally, the progression works, right? Because suddenly we'll connect with different kind of people as we are changing and growing, and people do grow in different directions throughout life and therefore make new friendships, and some people fall apart, and that's totally okay. Mm-hmm. And it's very, very natural, by the way. So that, I think that's the first part, to just acknowledge that this is simply part of life, right? That people will grow in different directions, and just because it was a friendship 20 years ago doesn't mean it's nurturing or good for either party today. And I also think it's not trying to caretake them and realize you're responsible for your emotions and they're responsible for their emotions. Mm-hmm. And they have to deal with their own emotions for whatever issue they might feel around you asserting your boundaries. And also, maybe if you don't want to let go of that relationship, because maybe it does give you something good, and it's not about discarding everybody who can't necessarily grow at the same pace, the same direction as us.
Right.
There might still be value in these friends, but then you might redefine your friendship with them as what you want, how you want to engage with them, and in what way you want to engage with them. So maybe you don't want to share intimate conversations with them, but you might still want to go do some dance class because you have fun dancing together, right? Mm-hmm. Then you can just contain the relationship to that section, which is fine and normal too, because again, part of when I talk about expectations and relationships and them being so unrealistic is that we take all these expectations that we used to get from a whole village, a whole tribe, you know, they have to be our safety, our provider, our connection, the person to make us laugh, our best friend, give us our sexual needs, all this stuff that we used to get from a whole village onto one person. And outsourcing these needs is perfectly healthy and natural, so all this doesn't fall on your partner. So having different things, and even saying this friend is just somebody I have fun with, you know, most of my friends are very good at being vulnerable, but I have a few that doesn't, and that's okay. I can still enjoy certain things I do with them, like going for a hike. Then we enjoy going for hikes together and nature, but there are certain things we won't talk about, and that's totally fine too. Yeah. So I think that's also just a thing to remember, that you can also just redefine your relationship of what you share with this person.
Mm-hmm. That is, there's so much like gold there, Tom. Thank you for sharing that. It's giving yourself the permission to let something go, and also giving yourself the permission to redefine something, even though, you know, it might've looked different 5 years ago. As you've grown, you can redefine it, and it can still be flourishing and thriving, but in a certain area of your life, instead of, you know, what you might have, what your idea of it could have been. And then the reality of it is, like, you know, you still are able to find joy and connection over shared experiences, but there might just be topics that you just naturally avoid or don't discuss. And I think that is, there's no pressure there. I like that mindset about friendships and how they serve different purposes.
Yeah, and being okay to step away from certain partner friendships that doesn't serve you anymore, but it doesn't mean you have to discard the whole friendship.
Right. That's really special. You mentioned, I want to dig into resentment really quick before the end of the show. So that's a really big topic, you know, it's like, let's just talk about resentment really quick. I want to talk about resentment, and you said it deteriorates relationships. And I know that we've talked a lot about different topics that, you know, I would say resentment has an element in a lot of the topics that we've talked about, and maybe how to avoid resentment. What happens if you're already in it? You know, you're already resenting something.
Yeah. And at that stage, it becomes quite difficult to start repairing a relationship, which is why, you know, I'll answer your question in a second, but I just really want to say this, because I think one of the sad parts is we have this idea that we should only seek out help if we're in trouble. Otherwise, people feel, I don't need help with our relationship, we're fine. That's typical what people would say. But the sad part is that is when people should go and learn about relationships, when they're fine, because that's when they're in a good place to implement these skills. And prevention is always better than trying to cure something that has gone wrong, right? It's better to prevent getting the corona than trying to cure once you have it. It's right. Better to put the vase in a safe place than bashing on the floor and then trying to put 100 different pieces together, because mm-hmm. it'll be difficult to fit all those pieces together. And even if you do, it won't look that well anymore, right? Mm-hmm. So why don't we put it in a safe place? So I always say prevention. What people should start doing is learning these skills and implementing them so they never get to that place. But your question was, what do we do if we have got to there? And of course, I think, first of all, healing conversations are needed. And it's absolutely essential that people are able to both be vulnerable and also acknowledge the other person. If people don't have that skill, then they can't really step out of this cycle, right? Mm-hmm. And if they have no self-awareness of why they're in this cycle, they also can't step out of it, which is why people need to learn about attachment styles, for example, because otherwise they will go around in what's called the demon dialogues, which is like I gave you an example of with the anxious and avoidant, right? And they will simply repeat these patterns. And even if they heal, they will replay the same pattern again. It's like going to theater and watching the same show again and again and again. So they have to get self-awareness and understand these skills to break the pattern. That's number one. And I think that's very important for people to understand that we need to learn these skills that nobody ever taught us. Relationships take skills to make it work and flourish over time. It doesn't just happen organically and naturally like we learn in Hollywood movies. That's called the honeymoon stage, and it can last from anywhere 6 months to 2 years maximum normally. where we have Mother Nature's help with these chemical cocktails, and then they will go away. And after that, it's all down to your skill. If you don't have the skill, it's unlikely to go that well long term. And then I think the second part is being able to sit down and get in touch with both, like we just talked about boundaries, so I will skip that part. And the second part is getting in touch with what our needs are. And actually, resentment can be a wonderful thing, because we have to remember that all emotions and sensations are just signals trying to tell us something. If you feel hungry, it's your sensation telling you to go eat. If you feel cold, it's your body telling you that you need to put on a sweater, right? Emotions are the same. If you feel anger, it's normally an emotion that communicates to you that you're being violated. And anger is basically a way we mobilize to stop violation. So it's normally, so when you feel anger, rather than lash out in anger, you could also say, I think some of my boundaries are being violated here. Let me just have a look what's happening, right? Because they're basically just messengers. That's all emotions are. They're not good or bad. They become bad if you don't listen to them or suppress them, because then they can become toxic. But anger is not bad. And again, I know a lot of women especially don't allow themselves to feel anger. Anger is a beautiful emotion, because it's actually there to tell you, hey, you're being violated. I need you to pay attention now and stop this, right? Mm-hmm. And if you listen to that, it's a great, resentment is the same. Resentment is often telling you, oh, there's some really key needs of yours that has been neglected for a long time. And one way that people can engage if they're stuck in resentment is to then sit down and figure out, what are these needs? What are the needs that have been neglected and not been heard? And then be able to express it. And again, yes, it requires a partner that's willing to listen and accept and try and engage with whatever needs they can fulfill. And if they can't, because again, disappointment is a natural phenomenon that will happen in any relationship, because we cannot accommodate all each other's needs, and you're not supposed to. But there's two ways to deal with disappointment. One is disconnecting, the other one is connecting. So one way, if we just say, you know what, this is your problem, you deal with it, right? You know, I could say that when she expressed that fantasy to me, I could say, it's your fantasy, your problem. If I'm fearful, that's normally how I would then have responded instead. And that would be very disconnecting. Then she would feel left alone, not heard, etc. But there's a way to actually create connection through disappointment. Instead, what I did, I sat down and I listened to her. And I said, I hear that this is really disappointing for you, because you really wanted to live out this fantasy. And I can't give you that. And I understand that's really, really disappointing. And I want to be here with you in that disappointment. So whenever you need to express it, let me know, and I'll sit down with you and I'll sit and listen to you. And can you see how that ended up actually turning disappointment into a connecting experience?
Right.
Because I create togetherness, and she's not left alone. And that's where connection happens. And I think that's very important as well, to understand how to deal with resentment. Because when suddenly all this come up, when resentment is expressed, then of course a lot of disappointment will be expressed. There will be a lot of disappointment about all these needs that were not met, right? Mm-hmm. And it's really important, you know, I did emotional focus therapy with my ex-wife after we separated. And people say, why would you do therapy afterwards? I said, because I need a relationship with this woman for the rest of my life. I have children with her, and it's really, really important for us to be able to engage in a healthy way. And to do that, we have to heal all this hurt and disappointment that happened. So, you know, I would sit and listen to her say, I was really disappointed. I felt left alone when I was pregnant with our second child. And I could sit there and then listen and acknowledge that. And I didn't try to take it away, because her disappointment for her was real. I didn't try to debate logically and say, oh, but I've done all this, you know, I was supporting the family, working hard, and I was dealing with our son's medical condition, trying to innovate, because that wouldn't go anywhere. That wouldn't make her feel hurt. Then we are back in the argument, back and forward. Instead, I just acknowledge her experience and recognize it doesn't mean I'm a bad person, because you know what? I know I'm a good person, and I know that eventually I will disappoint my partner. And my job is just to be there and listen to them when I do that, not always to try and fix it. Because I can't always fix it, and that doesn't make me a bad person.
Wow. I would have to say that you're probably one of the most emotionally healthy person I've probably ever talked to. I feel like I've learned so much. I'm taking pages of notes on this end.
Wonderful.
Why is this work? I mean, I know why it's important, because we're in a similar space talking about similar topics. Why is this work personal for you?
I think I just touched on that right now. So I think for a few reasons. I think number one, because I spent most of my life living in a really disconnected way. And I built up the American dream. I built up my business. I had 50 staff. We were turning over millions. I bought my house and my car, my motorbike in cash. I was working one day a week. People were saying, oh, you're so great. You're doing so successful. And I got all the validation. I had a beautiful girlfriend. And yet I felt so disconnected and lonely. And it took me to get to the stage, because I didn't have these skills back then. As I just mentioned, getting divorced, to sit down and say, and right after we have basically separated, I sat down and I thought, what is it? Why was I on? And this is something I had to acknowledge to her later, that I was, because she was very hurt that she never felt I loved her in the way she loved me. And afterwards, when I understood this, I could acknowledge, and I said to her, I'm so sorry, because you really deserve to be loved. And you're right. I was unable to love anyone in that way because I couldn't open up, and love can't flourish when we can't open up. So I couldn't give that to you. And that motivated me to go out and obviously make these changes, to start training, do workshops, go to America. I read in pretty much every research articles on relationships, social and emotional intelligence, that I could get a hold of, books, everything I could, and started implementing again and again and again. And I spent years doing this until this became a learned pattern. And, you know, I had this beautiful experience where for the first time I sat in a group of people and I was reading this. I thought, oh, I really don't want to do this. We were sitting and we had to share something vulnerable. And I thought, oh, shit, this sucks. I hope somebody will come through the door and shoot me. But that didn't happen.
Yeah.
So when it was my turn, sitting there, and I thought, okay, I have to share. I have to share this now. And I did. And I started crying and I shared how scared I was. In that time, the year my son was in intensive care, and every day I thought maybe he wouldn't make it, because they said he maybe wouldn't make it. And I never shared this or showed this, because at the time I thought I had to be tough and, you know, show I had it all together. And I cried like a baby, and they all just looked at me with compassion. And in that moment, I experienced what love and connection really is. Mm-hmm. And just a small little moment, even though I had no expectations of these people, they had no expectations of me. And I suddenly realized, wow, this is what I have been missing for my entire life. And we really don't have to buy into all these cultural messages anymore.
That's so special. Thank you for sharing that with me. That is beautiful. And very similarly, when you live a lot of your life and you were raised to, you know, have this image management, you know, where you can take care of it all on your own, or you can't share vulnerably, or you're like, again, working for that status, that ego part of our minds. And then you experience loss or trauma as an adult. There's something about that kind of shocks you, kind of like rocks you. And it's like, who am I? Who am I? Like, what do I feel? What do I want? And it can be really difficult, but it's also this beautiful journey of healing and like embracing who you are and embracing the fact that your emotions and your trauma and your experiences are very real, and they deserve to be held with care. And yeah, I'm just so thankful for the work that you do and thankful for you being on the podcast. I'm like in your corner, man. I'm cheering you on. Like, this is so amazing. And just thank you for sharing your story. I would love for you to share where people can connect with you and binge your podcast like I have been.
Of course. So you might put the link, because the name is a bit difficult, in the description, but it's called sendsensor.com. It's a website, and people can actually go on there and do the love language quiz. If they want to know what their love language is, they can do the attachment language quiz on there. It's all free, and figure out what their attachment language is, or their partner is, or attachment style, I mean. And there's a 1-hour free webinar. And of course they can go also listen to my podcast, which is also called Send Sensor. So yeah, we can put that in the description. And if people want to know more, then that's a right place to reach me.
Wonderful. Yeah, I will put that in the show notes, y'all. Thank you so much, Thomas. This has been such a gift. And I know that my community is going to find so much value and encouragement and just resources and language around a lot of the different topics that we covered today. So thank you so much for your time.
Oh, it's been a pleasure. Thank you for making this possible.